Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, frequent co-host Brett Hornig joins the podcast to talk about his fourth place finish at the 2022 Javelina 100. Now, this isn't just any race recap because one of the things that I appreciate about Brett is his ability to simultaneously put his coaching hat on and to talk about his experiences in ways that the listener can apply to their own training and their own running life in general. So in this conversation, Brett talks about being a student of the sport, the people he chatted with and took advice from in the lead up, how his philosophy around 100-mile training and racing has evolved, how he oriented his lifestyle for this training block, the whys behind nutrition, supplements, and gear that he used on race day, how each lap was executed, as well as how this result affects his mindset moving forward as a competitive athlete in the sport. Before we get started, this episode is brought to you by Inside Tracker, Kodiak Cakes, and Gnarly Nutrition. Simply go to the show notes section of this episode in your podcast player to get significant discount codes on all of their products. With that, let's get started. All right, we got my frequent co-host here, Brett Hornig, again on the pod. He's often here for the long run archives as well as pre-race banter for stuff like Western States and UTMB and the like. But we're actually interviewing him today because he just secured a fourth place finish at one of the most competitive ultramarathons in the U.S. this year, the Javelina 100. Brett, we're like 4 days, 5 days removed from this. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good, actually. I mean, I'm still pretty tired and my like eating is still all jacked up and all over the place, but nothing's broken. I'm sore in a lot of different spots that I haven't been sore after some other ultras, just simply due to how much running this was. But I feel like I actually got away from this one without any major injuries. So that's a huge win.
You ran collegiately at Southern Oregon University with a lot of household names in our sport, Ryan Gelfi, Eric Gelfi, David Laney, Eric Avila, Hoka Jared Hickson. But you've had great results in our sport too before, but I guess what I'm wondering, did it surprise you? Were you expecting it? Talk about how you've processed the result itself.
Yeah, I definitely was not expecting it, and it was very surprising. And I would say with pretty full certainty that this is the best running result I've ever had across all the running that I've ever done, which is really cool to finally be able to like say that again. I never thought it would come at 100 miles. I had just kind of come to peace that maybe that was just not really a thing for me. But yeah, it's been, what was the second half of your question?
Well,
my brain is still like fried from the race.
No, it's funny. You just said there that you were losing belief that the 100-mile distance would ever work for you. I know that offline, our mutual friend, Ryan Gelfi, told you that this was the result of an entire body of work in the sport. And I'm curious where you fall on that debate. Like, do you think that your performance at Javelina is a function of your last like 7 years in the sport, or were you doing anything out of the ordinary in this most recent training block that you think was what moved the needle?
You know, I think it's both. You know, it really is, you know, stacking training blocks and years of training together, that helps a lot with just the overall kind of base level of fitness. And I don't think the training block that I did before Javelina would have been possible without, you know, a lot of the prior seasons and years of running that I've done. So it's a little bit of both, because my training for this race was more different than it had ever been for any trail race I've ever trained for. So it was so much curiosity in regards to, I have no idea how I'm going to do because I've never quite trained like this, and I have no metrics for how prepared I am or how fit I actually am for this race. So there was so much mystery of it going in. And, you know, one of the things that I definitely did always try and remind myself was that regardless of how the actual race would play out, that, you know, I would kind of stick to the, you know, my race strategy in a similar way that I stuck to my training strategy for this race.
I think we definitely have all the time in the world here to go into the nitty gritty of the training itself. And I think one of the things that stuck out to me, because I had a chance to crew and pace you this weekend and just to hang out for 4 days straight, one of the things that stuck out to me is how curious of an athlete you are. Like you really truly seem to be a student of the sport. And that was demonstrated by all the people that you talked with at the race, like Camille Herron and Dakota Jones. I got the sense that during this training block, you reached out to like 5, 10, 15 people that had had experience at Javelina and were successful there, just to pick their brains. And was that the case? Am I kind of on point there?
Yeah, I've done that with most races that I've signed up for. If I know anyone that has done it before, I want to hear how it went, you know, what they would do differently, how their training was, how they thought it was or was not the right type of training for that course. You know, things, what were some things that happened that you did not see coming, you know, during the race? And I think a lot of those questions come from my years as a coach. And, you know, one thing that I believe, like, you're not a good coach if you're not continually always trying to learn more, because this sport it's never going to just like go stale in regards to the research and the data. There's always something new to be learned. And, you know, what I thought was maybe the ideal way to train for this race 6 years ago, completely different than how I would do it now. And that's just simply because what I know now is a lot, you know, greater than 6 years ago. And that will probably be the case 6 years from now. And I love that aspect of the sport. You know, I still kind of feel like the 100-mile distance is such a mystery in regards to the best way to train for it. It's kind of like, you know, the 40s trying to break 4 minutes in the mile for the first time, where there were some people running 9,000 miles a week. And then Roger Bannister's over here running a hard day, an easy day, and then a day off on repeat. And everyone was just doing such crazy different things, and it was all kind of getting similar results. And that's where a lot of 100-mile training is at still. And I think it's just such a fun time to be kind of growing in the sport with where, you know, the training science is.
That's really interesting. And I don't mean to put you on the spot here, because you definitely know more than I do in this area, but is it typically the case that as there's more experience around a particular event, like for example, the 10K or the marathon, training philosophies start to consolidate around one or two paths, as opposed to like 16 different ways to be successful at 100-mile? Like, do you think we're going to see a consolidation of philosophies in the next 5 to 10 years?
It still seems that as the distance gets longer, that window gets a little bit bigger. But, you know, people have been trying for a much longer time to run, say, the 10K at an elite level than the 100-mile. And many, many more people have tried it. There's been more dollars invested into the training behind it from a science standpoint, coaching, you know, brand sponsorship, that, you know, when you have more money for research, more research gets done. So that's where, you know, marathon and under has kind of taken the leaps that ultra running hasn't. And I think that's largely just due to participation and those events essentially just being around longer on the mainstream level. But even, you know, even something like training for the marathon has changed quite a bit in the last few years, as they're finally starting to dig more into lactate threshold testing and getting even better at fueling and realizing how much better you feel the day after a long run when you, you know, are training with your fuel, even if on paper you might technically not need to. Like, even all those things in the marathon world are still evolving and changing. And that's only just getting bigger and bigger as we move up in distance.
One of the things you said you noticed doing your research for this event was that the way people trained for this race 5 or 6 years ago is radically different, or very different from the way a lot of athletes are taking a crack at it now. So I guess I'm curious, from some of the conversations you had, maybe with Hal Kerner or Camille or anybody, what was the most revolutionary piece of advice you received that you ended up applying to your training?
So, I mean, the biggest, from a training standpoint, I didn't talk to a lot of these people. Like Cole and Camille and Hal, I talked to largely about the logistics of the race and the course, and what mistakes did people make out there? What did you do right? From a training standpoint, so much of what determined my training for this race was actually a conversation I had with David Laney after Western States, where I felt like, you know, Western States this year, I thought my training was the most complete it had ever been for 100 mile. I thought I paced the race well. My fueling was great. Never had any stomach issues. Hydration was great. Cooling was great. But the dynamite in the legs just still went off at about mile 80, which was about the same as the last time I ran States in 2018, severely undertrained and severely underfueled. And it was like, damn, I did so many things so much better this time, and I still blew up, you know. And I was faster this time around, but I just thought it would be, I thought it would be even more faster. And then it wasn't. And I was like, well, shoot, I really checked all the boxes. I guess that's just how good I am at 100 miles, and everyone has their event range. And then talking to David about it, I was like, David, if you were my coach and like you were looking at my training and like everything, like, what do you think? And, you know, he said, you know, Brett, you've always kind of been on the team of focus on your strengths and just make your strengths stronger instead of putting all this time into, you know, your weaknesses. And for me, that's always been like having decent speed, you know, and keeping, you know, a little bit more fast twitch throughout all my training blocks. And he was like, Brett, if you can't, you know, get the base, the strength base in your body to just complete 100 miles, it doesn't matter how fit you are, because you can't race the distance if you can't complete it. And, you know, one of the best bangs for your buck for, you know, developing a lot of that fatigue resistance is, you know, a little bit more easy, slower running, you know, and in my case, you know, getting invert, not so much in the climbing, but in the descending, and accumulating a lot of descending over the course of the training to just get the legs a little bit stronger. And that really is something that I had somewhat neglected on purpose in my training, because with the amount of intensity that I had in every week, once I hit a certain volume number in terms of hours per week, like usually around 11 hours of running per week, I would just start to get injured. And I figured that was just always kind of my physical limits, but I had never really made the conscious decision to drop a significant amount of intensity minutes in favor of adding more slow, easy running. And that's the biggest difference in my training for this Javelina block, was I ran more and climbed more for Javelina than I did for Western States, but I ran a significant amount less like workout time.
That's really okay. So I want to restate this back to see if I understand it correctly. Are you saying that if you're a runner and you're hitting like a 11 or 12 or 13 hour barrier when it comes to weekly time on feet, and you feel like you've just hit a wall in terms of being able to surpass that and get more volume in, it's likely a function of those hours spent on feet just being too intense? Like, most people are probably running those miles too fast?
Generally, but not always the case. Everyone's completely different, which is something that I've definitely learned coaching many different runners is that everyone's got different physical makeups. Everyone has a slightly different, you know, kind of ratio of fast twitch, slow twitch. Everyone's legs are shaped differently. Everyone runs a little bit different. You know, the hip angles are different from people, and that, and where they train is different. You know, what their day-to-day life is different. And that affects all those factors. And it's taken me a long time to figure out, like, and who knows, maybe I still haven't quite figured out. This was just like one piece that, you know, I changed, and it seemed like for this time around, it made a difference. And, you know, it's really cool to see at the very top end of our sport, like, you know, listening to the SWAT podcast with, you know, Killian and Koros doing a big article on Killian's, you know, UTMB data, as well as his training beforehand. Francois's talk on the Ritual podcast was incredible. So, you know, just recently listening to Killian, Courtney, and Francois all talking about their training, and the one big thing that they had in common is that they're all running a pretty high amount of volume. But it's not all coming in 10-hour runs. A lot of it is stupidly easy, like easier than anyone could have even fathomed, you know, for to see like Killian's heart rate data breakdown. You know, like he spends 60% of his time in his zone one. I can barely get out of a chair and stay in my zone one. Like that's just that's just incredible. And Francois and Courtney are very similar as well. So I didn't train, you know, by heart rate this training block, but I did record all my heart rate data and tried to do a, you know, a better job of just feeling it out. And I actually added up all my heart rate data for the whole training block, and I chunked it into weekly percentages in each zone. And if we can combine zone one and zone two into just one big easy zone, I spent about the same percentage of those minutes in that zone as like Killian was doing before UTMB, and similar percentage of time at threshold, which was not very much. I mean, granted, he was still running about twice as much minutes as I was, but from a percentage standpoint, I actually ended up sticking pretty close to that. I could put together a little spreadsheet and stuff, and we could throw that in the show notes.
One more thing. Yeah. You mentioned fatigue resistance earlier, and I'm not sure if this is connected, but did you ever feel when you were experimenting in your training block that it would be interesting or important to complete all of the demand, like the mileage demands and the time on feet demands for Javelina in a single week, week after week, like completing, I guess what I'm saying is, like, did you feel it was going to be necessary to run 90 to 100 mile weeks, week after week, for like 5 or 6 weeks to be at your best for Javelina?
I didn't know. That was the crazy part about it, was I kind of just figured like I would run, like I had never put together back to back 90 mile weeks. I actually don't.
It was
even
six.
Train. Yeah, it was about six, but I don't train by miles. I train by minutes, and the amount of time that I was running each week, I knew would come to about, you know, 95 to 100 miles. So I wasn't chasing, you know, 100 miles a week. I was chasing 15 to 15 and a half hours of running, and I wasn't going to chase it if I started to feel like garbage, but it felt fine. Like I didn't 15-hour weeks leading up to Javelina, you know, in the 6 weeks before the race, didn't feel any more difficult than some of the 11-hour weeks that I was doing before Western States. If anything, they felt better. And I think a lot of that might have just been due to me slowing down and having a little bit more patience, spending a little bit more time on the trail and a little bit less time on the roads, which is kind of opposite from what a lot of articles are coming out right now, where it's like trail runners run too much time on the roads and they need to develop their speed. But I think I'm coming from a slightly different spot of running, where I've still run more years of like track and cross country and, you know, training for 10K and shorter than I have trail and ultra marathon. So, yeah, my body, I've just never given my body the chance to even be able to stand on the start line of 100 and like think about competing. So that was always, that was the biggest goal going into this training block. And I had no idea if it was going to work. I still had no idea that it was going to work even like 80 miles into the race.
Maybe we've already covered it here, but is there anything that you now believe about training for 100 milers that was changed by your experience at Javelina, or I should say informed by your experience at Javelina?
I think it's such a case by case basis, but kind of as a lot of, you know, my friends and, you know, colleagues at Trails and Tarmac had kind of not expected, but believed, was like, if you can figure out a way to, you know, make that base of yours a little bit stronger, any speed that you neglect won't matter because it's still going to be enough for even something like Javelina that's considered a fast 100. And, you know, that was just something that I was always just really scared to let go of in my training because I really enjoy, you know, running interval workouts on the bike path. I just really like it. So it was just kind of like a scary thing to step out of my comfort zone and drop, you know, a good portion of that aspect of my training. But, you know, as of, you know, the sample size is, you know, one good 100 miler, but according to that one, a lot of that worked.
How, maybe talk also a bit about how much you oriented the last 3 months of your life around training for this race, like how all in you were from like a sun up to sundown standpoint preparing for this.
Yeah. I mean, I did probably the best job I ever have at just making, you know, running first thing on the priority list for the day. So all my runs, well, no, not all my runs were in the morning. All the important runs were when they needed to be done. So that doesn't necessarily mean that every single run was done first thing in the morning. You know, a lot of my runs I did in the afternoon because it was warm in Ashland all the way up until about 10 days before the race. So I needed to take advantage of that. And like, I almost purposely tried to make my training, like I made sure to get in all the running, but you know, all my runs were at a lot of different times during the day, which is actually something that I don't normally do. You know, I'm usually like I run at 8 a.m. every morning sort of thing. But, you know, if it's going to be hot during the race, I needed to run during hot times. And, you know, even some, you know, I almost tried to like sabotage myself on some runs, kind of like Michael Phelps's coach would like purposely forget his goggles going to a race and be like, oh, looks like you got to swim with no goggles today. You know, almost kind of like tried to create some difficulty and my training runs, just to, I don't know, eliminate some of those potential surprise factors, in the race, whether that's like, I mean that, and a couple of them were just sheer dumb luck of me. Like I did one long run for my parents' house in the Bay Area and it was like 90 degrees out. And I just underestimated how long the first loop was going to be and how much fluid that I had. So I did like the first half of the run and I got really dehydrated. And then all of a sudden it went from like running miles 0 to 20 of a race. And then all of a sudden I fast forwarded to like miles, you know, 60 to 80, because then the last 20 were really hard. And I know doing that every single week is not good for you, but having that mental challenge, you know, once was, I remembered that run during Javelina. And then, you know, there was other ones where like I cross-threaded one of my bottles on a run. And like, I leaked the whole thing out of me like midway through. And then all of a sudden I had half the fluids or the half the calories I needed to, cause it was like a 300 calorie bottle. And just like stupid things like that, that ended up helping make the actual race day go smoother. So it was just so many different things in my training, but you know, the one thing that I did do is like try and prioritize the running and also prioritize the recovery. You know, like I drank a recovery shake after every single run I did. And it had a little more protein in it. Like, I think I upped my protein intake training for this race a good amount more than other races. And maybe that was one of the things that kept me healthy, you know? And so, you know, just continuing to prioritize the running, the recovery, and, you know, that led to some things going a little bit better than they had last time.
Anything else on the training front for this race? Any insights that you think the audience would be interested in hearing about and maybe applying to their own training?
You know, I mean, when I talked with Cole Watson and Camille Herron about this race, you know, they paralleled a lot of things that they said. And like, one of the most important things was like, don't be dumb the first two laps. Like, you don't need to be going out super hard, you know, just cause it's cooler out, and then just be like, okay, then I'll slow down. It's like, there's never been a race that's worked like that. Like, no one goes, like, Eliud Kipchoge doesn't go out at 140 marathon pace just so he can bank 20 minutes to slow down to 2 hours. Like, that's just not how, like, physiologically running your best race works. So they're always like, yeah, just like hit your right effort, but make sure then you go into the heat of the day having done enough of the right things early on where you're able to battle the heat better. Because if you are battling the heat better, that's going to lead to a better fourth lap and a better fifth lap. Because, I mean, it's so hard to go out fast, slow down a ton, and then all of a sudden speed up again. That's just so difficult to do. And like, the way that jacks with your fuel stores, like, good luck replenishing like your glycogen stores when it's 85 degrees out, when you're overheated, when you now feel like crap because you went out too hard. So that's what both of them like really like reiterated to me. And Cole, you know, fully spelled out like how he did the whole like coming into the start and finish area, which is exactly what we did. You know, the way he told me, like, he drew it out and was like, it looks like an umbrella handle and you can like start getting crude as soon as you come into it and come out. So like, you know, I mean, for those who are listening, Finn was, you know, a huge part of my crew as well as paced me on the fourth lap. But do you feel like how we managed the in and out of each lap, I feel like that was about as efficient as it could have been.
It was incredibly efficient. I definitely made some snafus on the first lap, largely because I was shocked.
Well, I snuck up on you a little bit.
Yeah. How quickly you got it. And we'll get into that in a second. But yeah, there's no question, like, the game plan that you had set up for our crew was dialed, and that it was informed by Cole and people who've done this race right in the past. One question I want to ask you though, before we get into like how we executed the day, and I'll say this with the caveat that, you know, you obviously focused on getting in the proper training, the proper nutrition, and the proper sleep day in and day out. But I learned over the weekend how avant-garde you are when it comes to like supplementation for races and stuff like that. And maybe we even give a shout out to The Feed, which is an incredible website that I learned about a couple of days ago. But can you talk about some of the stuff you used for Javelina and how you think it panned out?
Yeah, I mean, I just, as with like training science is ever evolving, so is the fueling portion of running, you know, pre, during, post. So, I mean, and like, that's just, I've always been like, what's the newest running shoe coming out? Like, how are running shoes getting better? How is anything getting better? You know, how are gels getting better? How is drink mix getting better? So there's always something new for me to try. And like, perhaps that's been a downfall of me in the past, of being like, I don't know what shoes I'm going to wear during the race, or like, I can't stick to just training with one particular gel. But yeah, so it's been like a never ending game of like, what is not the latest and greatest, but like, what are, you know, where's current science at with, you know, fueling during a race. And, you know, so much of it's like high carb fueling. And a lot of this is what I gather from, you know, like the cycling world on the elite side of it, because I'm a decent sized cycling fan. And it just seems like the cycling world is always years ahead of the running world in terms of...
What explains that, by the way, in your opinion?
I feel like it's part kind of the nature of cycling. Like it's always been the relationship between body and machine, because you need your bicycle to be very efficient. And like, it's, if you don't have any, you know, and that's where a lot of people like running, is you don't have to worry about all that crap. But I've always loved riding bikes. Like that was my first love before running. And I always, you know, just liked how everything works and tinkering with it. And with that mindset comes a lot of, you know, the fueling and gear part of it. So it seems like, you know, when we're comparing elite cycling to elite trail and ultra running, there's so much more money in research in that side of the sport. So, you know, like the gels that I was eating at Javelina were by a company called Never Second. They are the nutrition sponsor for the top cycling team in the world, team Jumbo Visma. And I had never heard of them before until I watched the tour this year. And then I saw that they were selling them on the feed. And the great thing about the feed is you don't have to buy an entire box. So I just bought a couple of every single gel company that I'd never heard of. And I was like, wow, I love these Never Second gels. They're, you know, volume wise, twice as big as a goo. And, you know, maybe just 50% more carbohydrates. So they're a lot easier to get down and they don't, you know, kick your mouth with slime. So, you know, I was able to eat three of those plus a bottle of kind of high calorie carb drink, as well as some like honey stinger chews. Those are kind of always my go-to. You know, I was able to do that every single lap, the entire race. And is it because of that, like one particular brand? You know, maybe it's because I found something that like I enjoy the taste of an eating, or maybe it's just kind of like going back to what Ryan Gelfi said, like 7-8 years of doing this, it just becomes a little bit more automatic. You know, it's less of like, oh crap, I don't want to eat another goo, but it's more just like, this is fuel for my body, gulp. And then you just kind of do it. And, you know, talking to Hal Kerner so much, he was like, man, you guys, you have so many choices. You're so lucky. Like when I was running Hard Rock, it was 2 goos an hour and your choices were vanilla or chai bean, like, but you just do it. And I'm like, wow, you're right. If you can eat 2 gels an hour for 24 hours of just vanilla or chai bean, I can do it. I could do it too.
Oh my gosh. How about, we got to talk about gear too. So what were you wearing for shoes and then like pack and stuff like that? Just what was the equipment?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I guess the last bit of the fueling is, the exogenous ketones that,
oh my gosh. Yeah.
That are new to running maybe. Or it might just be that like a lot of top runners drink them, but like no one just says anything. But then this is probably the newest bit of fueling science. And, you know, it's essentially like the byproduct of being on the keto diet and like getting into ketosis. And I think, you know, I'm definitely not a scientist and like I've read a decent amount, but I don't fully, like I wouldn't be able to teach a class on it. But, you know, as I understand it, it kind of sounds like ketones can be now basically an extra fuel source in your body. Because like if you're a keto athlete and you're in ketosis, you now don't have the carbohydrate and glycogen aspect of your fueling. If you're not a keto athlete and you're just doing the normal runner carb goose thing, you're not utilizing, you know, like ketones as fuel because your liver's not developing them because you're not in ketosis. There's companies that have made these ketones and now like you drink them and then now you kind of get both, like you have like dual sourced fueling, which it sounds like the results have been like wildly different from person to person. And a lot of that's just due to like your metabolic rates. But the whole idea behind it is like, you now have two gas tanks, and that also keeps the carbohydrate side of your gas tank much more level. So like, I feel like that allowed like the mental clarity of the race and like being able to think a lot better. You know, it's very, very new, kind of new science. There's been some research done on it, but like, it's all like currently happening right now. So a lot of stuff isn't published, but it sounds like ketones on like the hierarchy of fuel usage, your brain utilizes ketones a lot more than carbohydrates if there's both sources of fuel in your body. So, yeah, I feel like I was able to think more clearly during the race, which was great. Cause like I wouldn't lose track of time in regards to my fueling intervals. I wasn't making stupid foot placements. I always knew where I was on the course. In past races, I've like kind of, you kind of lose track. Your mind starts to wander and you're like, oh crap, how long have I been climbing for? Like, how far is it actually to the next aid station? You know, is that a byproduct of the ketones? I don't know. Maybe it's years of me having done this now and it's just becoming a little bit more automatic. So yeah, again, it's one of those things where it's like N of one, like these are all the things that I did for my race. They seemed like they worked for me. Does that mean it, everyone should be following this exact plan? Like, absolutely not. Like it's a learning process for everyone.
Let's talk about gear, shoes, yeah. Pack, et cetera. What were you using?
So shoes, again, was fighting demons about what the hell shoes I was going to wear, like all the way up until the month before the race. And then I went on one long run in an old pair of Saucony Endorphin Pro 2 shoes, which is Saucony's, you know, marathon super shoe, which in my book is only kind of like a half a super shoe. I've called it a super trainer because you can kind of hit all your workout paces in it, but I would never race a marathon in it. I'd throw on a Vaporfly or an Alphafly. But I loved it as a trainer and I just felt like I just wanted to throw them on one day. So I did. And then I was thinking, oh wow, I love this shoe. I forgot how great this shoe feels on dirt. Not technical dirt, but just a little bit of, you know, easy like dirt roads or rolling single track. And then I was thinking like, okay, the Endorphin Speed doesn't have a carbon plate. It's got a nylon plate, which is a little bit more flexible. People have said there are, like Cole said, he wouldn't wear a Vaporfly because he thought there was just a few too many rocks where the carbon plate would kind of dump the foot. And I think I agree with him. You know, Nick Curry might disagree with me, but I was like, that makes sense because I roll my ankles a lot. So I thought maybe a nylon plate that kind of splits the difference. It's a little bit stiff, but not as stiff as a carbon plate, would still move with the trail a little more. And then I'd get the super bouncy Saucony foam and a really nice breathable upper. And the shoe's very light, you know, it only weighs 8 ounces. And everything I heard, you didn't need to worry about grip or anything like that. And then the plate did still provide some nice rock protection. And so I bought a pair like a month before the race and I put like 50 miles on them because I know that I had already put, you know, almost 400 miles on one of the older models. And it, for me, it was the perfect shoe. Like I would absolutely wear it again. It was fantastic. I got no blisters, no hot spots. I didn't change my shoes. I changed my socks once just because something was like poking me through my sock and it was just starting to bug me. But then I put the shoes straight back on. You know, they got soaked a couple times when I was cooling off and they dried so fast. So I couldn't be happier with the shoe choice, and they were bright pink and looked pretty awesome. I didn't go for a pack. I did waste. I did the Adam Peterman special, which was a waist belt with one bottle and then holding one other bottle. Which is what I saw at pictures of him at States. And I was like, I like that. I don't love the double bottle because I like switching hands and I like having a free hand to open gels and all that good stuff with. And that was great. The problem I ran into was like, I think I broke a stitch or something on my waist belt, somewhere around lap 3. And then it was not tight anymore with a bottle in it. And it was just bouncing all over the place. So then for the second half of lap three, I was just holding both my bottles, thinking how much of a disaster this was about to be the next two laps, because I now can't hold a bottle. But fortunately, you know, Eli, who was also at the race with us, well, unfortunately, he had to stop after a couple laps because his body was just like not cooperating with him. Fortunately, him and I are close enough waist size where then I was able to use his naked belt. So like it already had like a nice layer of salt going on. It was very starchy. But when I pulled into the end of lap three, he was like, dude, if you need a waist belt, like there's mine. I was like, oh my gosh, like I gotta try. I'm going for it. So then I threw his on and it was great. And I just used that for the rest of the race. What other parts of the gear? Oh yeah. I wore a singlet by, Dylan Running. That's DYLN. We can link to it. It's one of my college teammates. It's a clothing brand that he's starting up, and I think they launched about a month ago. So, you know, when your friend starts a new clothing brand, you wear their singlet.
Maybe we talk about the race itself here. And I think in terms of format, there were five laps at Javelina. Maybe you give like a 1 minute elevator pitch, or not pitch, but just summary of how they went. And then we can from there pick rabbit holes to go down that might be valuable to the audience.
Yeah, totally. Or if there's any questions you have, like throughout any of the laps, just like throw them out there. But yeah, I mean, lap one, we start and you start the race going slightly downhill, and I swear we were going slower than the starting 200 meters of Western States going up the escarpment. Like it was so much more casual, and I couldn't tell if that's just because I'm way better at starting a flat, like a race on flat, than a race going uphill. So like I was immediately right in the front pack once we exited the trail. You know, I was in like 15th place or something, but you know, me and 15, you know, the leader to me, we're all going the same speed, even though they were a couple seconds in front of me, you know, so we were just running along. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going the same speed as the leaders right now. And then going through the first aid station, you know, like we just all blew through it. I'm like still there. But it felt, the effort felt correct. And I was like, wow, I'm still with the leaders 3 miles in. This has never happened ever, but it feels fine. So I'm just going to like pretend that I belong here and like see what happens. And I'm, you know, getting up through Jackass. I'm like running next to Matt Daniels and we're talking and I'm just like, oh man, something is not right. Like, why am I here? And why are these people not going faster? But you know, and then, I mean, I saw the average pace and I was like, oh, this is actually plenty fast enough, like perhaps too fast, but it feels fine. And I'm loving this right now. Like, this is so fun. So that rolled all the way through to the first lap. And then going into lap two, it spread out a little bit more, but like still pretty much right with the leaders.
You came in like under 20 minutes on your split, like 20 minutes under planned splits too, I think.
Yeah. What did I, oh, I have it up right here. So I wrote 14 hour splits and I actually said 2:58 for that lap, but like the 14 hour splits were like a joke. You know, I was really figuring I would be closer to 15 hour splits. Like the 14 hour was like, you know, best day of my life. I'll write it down, but like, why would that ever actually happen in 100 mile? I have like no evidence that this would ever happen, but I'm going to write it down anyways. I wrote 2:58. For that, and I think we came through in like 2:45, 2:50.
Yeah, and you were so under that, and you mentioned Cole gave you that horseshoe strategy. I would always meet you at the top of the horseshoe where you were coming in with a bottle that you would grab to spray yourself down and to drink if you wanted to. I would grab all your empty stuff and I would basically jog it back to the to our camp while you went and touched the timing mat on the other side of the horseshoe and came back. And I was just totally taken by surprise because like I had literally just walked up there, had my back turned to where you were coming through because I just assumed like, yeah, he'll be here in like 15, 20 minutes. And
Yeah, like why would I be like, coming in?
And I had all the stuff on ice, so I had to open up the cooler I had it in, like rummage through the ice, grab it, and like you were already like, you know, 100 yards down the tunnel. I had to catch up to it, so it was crazy.
Yeah, which I knew that was going to happen. So it didn't send me into a state of panic like seeing you not ready, because the better race you're having, the less you've like, it's funny, like the better race you're having, the less you need your like crew or pacers for like morale. Mm. But I've always just been a pretty calm racer and like never being like, okay, we gotta do this. And like, we're just like throwing stuff all over the place, where it's like, I've always been a very calm runner. And it's like, all right, like I'm going to come in, we'll get the bottles, we'll, you know, do the ice, all this stuff, and then we'll be on our way. And like doing everything in what, at in present time feels like it's in slow motion and like, oh my God, we're wasting so much time. We were in and out like a minute shy of the one time I changed my socks. So, yeah, I mean, that all worked. And then, yeah, so going into loop two, we threw the ice bandana on, which was freezing. I was not hot at that point, but that's fine. It was cold. And I think I was a little bit, I think I was in fourth. I think I left lap two in fourth or fifth place. And I was told that, and like that freaked me out the most of like, oh wow, that's a small number. And that number can't get much smaller over the course of the next, you know, three laps or four laps, I guess, at this point. Like, what have I done? Well, I guess I've done it. So I guess I'm just going to continue doing it. So then I think I was running like right behind Pat Regan, and I might have even been ahead of Arlen Glick at this point. And I'm just like, what am I doing? Like, this is like three-time champ, course record holder. This guy just won it last year and like blew the doors off me at States. What am I doing? Oh, well, if I blow up after lap two, this is still like the most fun I've had in a race. So I'm just going to keep rolling with it, because the effort still felt correct. And that was the main thing that I was trying to pay attention to, was like, stay on top of your fueling. Does the effort feel correct? If yes, do it. So that was what I stuck to. And then lap three happened, and you know, we did our crew aid station stuff. Soon as I started climbing on lap three, it felt a lot harder than lap two. And I've never broken through a wall in 100 miler, pretty much at any point, whenever my legs start to feel like how they did. The day is done. I will finish. It's going to be slow. It is what it is. And this was happening, you know, at lap 40 or mile 42, 43. I'm like, okay, legs are starting to lose steam. Well, I'm going to be walk jogging laps 4 and 5. Bummer. But I loved the first two laps. It was so much fun. I had a blast. I will, instead of letting up and, you know, playing it safe and going into like survival mode for the last 4 or 5, I was like, I'm just going to keep pressing. I'm going to keep leaning into it. And like, I'm just going to continue to blindly commit to just going by feel and race. And, you know, I love racing. And I was like, this is the first time I've ever been to like, even think about competing in 100, like, I'm just going to keep going, like, just keep going. And lap three felt like crap. I got to the Jackass aid station and like held onto the table to stretch my quad, because my quads have always been the thing to go. And as soon as I lifted my leg up to go stretch my quad, I went into a full hamstring cramp and like almost tipped over the ice table. I was just like, oh my God. And then, yeah. And then I had to like stop and kind of like stretch that out and like ice myself down and like kind of walk jog out of the aid station and like try and not let that happen again. I was like, oh, it's going to be like that. Okay. Like, and then I was just thinking like, Finn's going to pace me on the fourth lap. I've got 10 miles to get there, man. I feel bad for him. He's going to get so sunburnt, 'cause we're going to be out there so long. We got to grab the extra headlamp, you know, all that. I'm going to need a long sleeve because it's going to get dark. And, you know, but I didn't let up on the second half of that lap. Like, I still kept kind of pressing and was like, you know what? I'm just going to keep trying. And if I like royally explode, I'm going to let it happen, but I'm not going to throw in the towel yet. And then I still don't know why or how. Maybe it was just like having you as company on that fourth lap, like just really helped change the mindset, but like things really started to turn around on the fourth lap. And like, I wasn't slowing down anymore. You know, I think I slowed down a little bit on the fourth lap, but not that much. You know, I thought it was going to be like an hour slower. And then the fourth lap was like a real life long run archives. It was awesome. We just chatted about everything. It was fantastic.
I learned you were an Oakland Raiders fan.
Yep. Still am, of course. yeah, we talked a lot about football. We talked about things that we might not normally talk about on a long run archives. But yeah, it was awesome. And it was so great to have company on that lap. And like, I don't know, how do you feel that lap went? Like, I feel like it went well. Like, it went so much better than I thought it was going to based off of how lap three went.
I was in a little bit of disbelief. And obviously I no longer question anything. If anything, I question my own perceptions of limitations, but like there were a couple climbs you had in those first 8 to 9 miles of the lap where for a very brief amount of time, it got to like 10, 15, 20% grade. And like, you just jogged them like they were no problem. And I've never had a crewing. This was my first crewing experience or pacing experience where the runner was still in the thick of it. Like you said, still trying, still in contention, running hard that late into the race. That was my first experience being with a runner like in it. And so I kept saying,
mine
to
as
I think,
well.
Yeah. And I kept saying,
that was my first time like, being in the thick of it as well.
I remember saying things to you like, you know, Brett, like you may be going too fast here. And I still think there's a lot of race left and maybe, you know, it's okay to jog this climb for a little bit. And like, you were just like, fuck that. And like, you just kept doing it. Like, great. And it actually got to a point where, and we had talked about this offline, like there was a really real possibility that you could have dropped me there. And I don't think I could have made it. I think I did 20 miles with you. And I was like,
because you were going to do 40.
I was going to do 40. And thank you, Eli, you know, for the scenario that unfolded because, you know, our mutual buddy, Eric Gelfi, was able to hop in for that last lap. Praise Jesus. And so, yeah, that was my experience.
Yeah. And, you know, and then kind of what I was telling, I mean, we talked about this on the lap. I was like, you know, if this, you know, even on the way up, I was like, dude, I feel either the same or better than lap three. If I can have a good lap four, I'm going to have a good lap five. Like if I can set the tone right now, lap five will be good. I know it. Even if I press pretty hard on lap four, like lap five is going to work. I will make it work. And that was what I kept telling myself. And then, yeah, going into lap five with Eric, you know, we ran almost the entire first half of the lap in the light, which there was no amount of, visualizing that I did before the race where I even started the fifth lap in the light. I thought that I would be coming in to the end of the fourth lap and it was just getting dark on my best day. But we got almost halfway done with that fifth lap before I had to throw my headlamp on. And yeah, and same thing, you know, as soon as we started, I was like, all right, like I'm, you know, not counting my chickens before they hatch. Like we are very much in full race mode still. I'm not thinking about the finish. I'm not thinking about the celebration or any of that stuff. I'm like, anything can happen still on this lap. So I am going to just keep trying to stay my best to like be locked in to what I've been doing the entire race. And I am not going to let my mind wander until I get into that finish shoot basically. And Eric was like, okay, like I understand. Like, that's what we're doing. Like, let's do it. And you know, the biggest thing that he was doing was just like making sure that, you know, I was fueling correctly. And like he had his, you know, he had the watch going on just the individual lap, whereas mine was going on the entire race. So like, you know, it's like, okay, we've got about this many minutes to the next aid station. We weren't even talking about the entire lap. It's more just like the entire race was just running from one aid station to the next. and breaking it down into as many little pieces as possible and just never thinking about the entirety of the race. And then, you know, like I still ate a gel. I had 5 gels on the last lap, cause I didn't want to leave any time out on the table. So like, you know, I think the last gel that I ate was at mile 98 or 97 and a half, just past the last aid station. And at that point, you know, we were like, yeah, we were just full hammering at that point. And like, you know, it's a lot of the time, most of the time I had always been like, oh, I'm close enough to the finish. I can like fade in. I don't need to eat anymore because I'm so sick of it. I was just like, grabbed a pineapple roctane gel off the aid station, was like, I am slamming this, even though I had just eaten one before coming into the aid station. Cause I was like, I don't want anything to happen. And like, it was just so cool that I was able to stay. Like, I'm so proud of myself for being able to stay that engaged in the race the whole time. Like, that's something I've just never been able to do.
If you look back at the whole race, you know, I know you mentioned earlier in your environment was Arlen Glick all day and Pat Regan and Matt Daniels and just these giants of the sport. Did you, at this point, now that you've had a fourth place finish at Javelina, one of the most competitive ultras in the US of 2022, do you feel a sense of belonging in that category now? Or do you still feel like an outsider?
You know, had you asked me that question, you know, 5 years ago, I would have been like, I feel like I belong now. I don't feel like an outsider. Asking me it now, I don't really care where I fall compared to other people. You know, I've stopped trying to be an elite runner or like chase a contract or things like that, like years ago. And I guess maybe that's a mindset change, but like, I've just been doing it for me more. And like all of this, for the whole thing for Javelina was not like, I want to beat some people that are sponsored so I can get sponsored. It was more like, I want to run the best race I can. And I want to see if I can prove to myself that I can do something that I think I can do, but just still have never been able to pull off. So, you know, like, I was talking to Joey Corsione before the race and we were talking about goals and stuff. And, you know, I told him, I was like, yeah, one of my goals is just to execute all the elements of the race. And I'm pretty sure if I do that, the byproduct will be, you know, a higher up place or time that I've ever done than I've ever done before, but that's not the goal. I'm not trying to get in the top five. You know, like I could have very well run 16 hours and gotten, you know, 12th place or 15th place. But if I feel like I executed all the bits and pieces of the race well, I was going to be happy with that.
Yeah.
So I never once thought like, you know, if I ran 14 hours and felt like shit the whole time and did a whole bunch of things wrong, I wouldn't have called that a success. Not that that was ever going to happen, because there's no scenario where I don't feel good and run 14 hours, because that's crazy. But yeah, the whole point of this race was to just like try hard, do the right things, and then see where that lands you. So that was always the goal. And like, and I'm so happy that it ended up being a high finish and a time that I didn't even allow myself to think about. Like, that's so cool. And maybe that is a byproduct of changing my reasons for doing these races.
I think you gotta give the audience the line that you gave me about how at one point in time you were comparing yourself to elite athletes, but now you're comparing yourself to the media personnel in our sport. So what's that line again?
Yeah, weird. I mean, maybe is it a joke? I don't know. I was like, Finn, I'm thinking of rebranding myself. I've always been like the slow elite. Like, I've always been one of the faster guys without a contract. And that's just always been my place in the running world. Like, but maybe now I can be seen as like one of the faster media guys. And like, now I'm not a guy who's out there supposed to run, but he actually talks about running and he coaches. And then it's just like, wow, I didn't know he could run too. I was like, I would so much rather be that guy.
It's an amazing reframe. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's just like the under promise, over deliver. just like to the max.
One other thing I wanted to cover, you got fourth place. Arlen Glick already had a spot secured to Western States. John Rea and Dakota Jones accepted the tickets, but there's a new policy effective for this year where if for some reason John or Dakota give up their tickets before May 1st, it rolls down, I think, to at least fifth, which means that you would have a chance to accept or reject it. I know that, you know, that day is 6-7 months away and probably unlikely because both of those guys are, you know, gung-ho about doing Western. But if that ever fell to you, would you take it?
I mean, it's funny. I didn't run Javelina like thinking that I would have a chance at a golden ticket. Like I've done golden ticket races before thinking like, I'm going to get a golden ticket here and then just getting my ass kicked. And I was like, that's how this is going to go. And after Western States this year, I was like pretty at peace with the race of like, that's how good I am at Western States. That's how good I am at 100 miles. Okay, Brett, time to move on. That's why I did Javelina, because I wanted to train for something different and do it super different. But if the opportunity to run Western States came up, like, I mean, it's been a long enough amount of days since Javelina where I'm starting to think a little bit more like, wow, what if I trained for Western States in the same way I trained for Javelina and like did some of those things again, like, oh, maybe it could actually be better. So yeah, I would probably run it.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Well, what's next for you racing wise?
I have no idea. I not signed up for anything past Javelina. I kind of did that on purpose. I didn't want to have anything to distract myself and look forward to. I did the same thing with Western States this year. Like I had no races on the schedule up until, you know, after Western States. So I really haven't thought at all about what I would do after Javelina. You're going down to Black Canyon and there's some other friends that are doing Black Canyon. So I was like, oh, wow, Black Canyon would be really fun. You know, I really liked running in the desert. It's kind of like soon though. So that's like, I don't know. I've always wanted to go back and do Lake Sonoma again. That's a really fun one. I also like still am half like, half of me is like, Brett, you should just retire from racing because this is as good as it gets. And I can just bask in the glory days now for the rest of my time here on this earth. So yeah, to answer your question, like I still really don't know from a racing standpoint what I want to do. I just want to recover from this race and enjoy some time just chilling. Like I've walked a total of like 400 steps since the race. Like I haven't done anything, and I've loved it. I've loved every minute of not doing anything since the race.
Does this in any way, shape, or form reignite the Rogue Valley Rancheros?
The Rogue Valley Rancheros. I don't even know how many people know of that name. We just thought it would be funny to, you know, come out swinging against the Coconino Cowboys when they created their group and then everybody moved away. But yeah, I mean, I hope this brings some additional fire to the Rogue Valley Rancheros. And you know, I mean, there's still a ton of people living in Ashland running and training for ultras as well as like road races and stuff too. There's a great running community. So, it was never gone, Finn. It was never gone.
I think I had shots fired in a recent Long Run Archives episode when I called Ashland the former Mecca of our sport. Brett made a statement at Javelina saying it never left, apparently.
I guess so. I don't know.
Awesome, man. Well, all I can say from my perspective is it was an awesome experience. It was great to chill for 4 days. It was cool to see what happens when you work really hard behind the scenes and then show up on race day and everything goes sort of as deservedly planned. And, you know, I know there's a lot of speculation about what you do next, and you're doing a great job of just savoring the moment, being in the moment, being kind of zen about what you do immediately in the aftermath. But I'm super impressed. And I think a lot of what we talked about here today was valuable to the audience too. Like, they'll probably apply it to their own training moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, it was so fun. It was such a fun weekend, like just the entire trip and like the conversations that we had with, you know, so many people. It just made it like, that's really what makes, you know, a lot of these trips to me. I'm like, yeah, the race was super fun. And like, it definitely wasn't fun the whole time. I mean, there were parts of it that sucked, but that's, you know, you ask anyone who's like run a really high performance 100 mile, not even high, like just their best 100 mile, they'll be like, oh yeah, there was always low points, but you know, we battled through it. And like, that's how any of these long races go. So like, you can't just think like, oh, they won the race or they ran really well. Like, it was easy for them the whole time. And it's like, no, I'm still trying really hard and this kind of sucks, but like, I'm just going to continue onward. But yeah, like it was just so much fun. And I mean, yeah, I mean, the amount of times that we were just like busting up laughing, some of the conversations that was going on, like, yeah, it was awesome. Like, it was just so fun. And yeah, I would love to do that again. I mean, I would love to. I'll crew and pace you at Javelina next year.
I think I'm going to do crewing again. It's such a fun experience. And also, like you mentioned, I know that we have Twitter and email and Strava and podcasts, but one of the parting thoughts I have about this experience was Javelina, and I think most races are an incredible networking tool. There are conversations that, and there's people you meet and relationships you form that you it would be hard to replicate, I think, digitally or like over the phone. I mean, I feel like even like our relationship got stronger, and like it makes me want to be more present in the physical community, like multiple times a month. I don't know if you got that same
impression. Oh yeah, 100%. Cause I mean, everything, you know, even if you just like text or call someone or like have that conversation that way, it's like, it's planned. But you know, if we're just walking from the parking lot to the pizza trailer that they had, you know, we just run into people and then we start talking to them. Those types of conversations, those don't happen unless you're all there in person. And some of those are the most fun ones to have. And, you know, I mean, and that just goes to how amazing of a job Aravaipa has done with the Javelina 100. Like, that's a race that I would now recommend to everyone to do, just simply because of how incredible of a kind of community of not only just the employees, the vendors, the volunteers, and then all the people and the crew, and they all get to hang out at one spot all day. And they make it such a just big ass fun party. And it made me like really sad each time I left the loop to go out run on the course. I was like, oh, I'm going to miss all of the fun that they're having over there. And yeah, like that's something I can get behind for sure.
We'll have to reunite at Black Canyon.
World-class event. Yeah, in some way or another, I would love to be there.
Well, a couple housekeeping items here before we close up. In November, so this month, we're recording this November 2nd. We're going to do an Ultra Trail Cape Town preview episode with Leah. And then we have a long run archives episode with Danny Marino. We're sort of playing in the world of this Battle of the Brands concept that she posted about on Instagram, and we'll link to that in the show notes. And then we'll link up with Leah again in December to do sort of like an end of the year, what was interesting in ultra running, ultra runner of the year speculation type episode that I think is going to be fun as well. And then I'm guessing like in January, onward, we'll keep doing golden ticket stuff. So I think we got an exciting couple of months on single track ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be awesome. Like, there is no downtime in this sport. There is no season, which makes it really fun from a viewer standpoint, because there's always kind of something to pay attention to, which is great. So I'm excited. I'm excited for that, and excited to get back in the booth, not be doing all this running hoopla. just talk about it.
Maybe, and maybe we'll just put this out into the universe, but if there are any race directors that listen to this show that need any slots filled for race coverage across the globe, let us know. We talked about that this weekend as something we're interested in. And the last time we put something out into the universe, it was decaf coffee, and we got 4 bags. So a lot of promise there. But any, I'll give you the last word. Any parting thoughts before we go?
Yeah, I mean, it's just been, this has been so fun. The training for the race and like, I guess taking a risk in that regard of, you know, training completely different, racing completely different. I paid attention to almost no metrics during the race, which is something that I've always done. Like I recorded my heart rate during the race, but I didn't look at it once. I saw my average pace for the entire day, but I never keyed off of it. I kept a timer going for my nutrition, and that was about it. Everything else was just reacting off of what I saw and how I felt. And it's just been such a like magical experience. And yeah, I definitely still am like not having a good time, but like wrapping my head around and like believing that I actually ran 13:45 on that course. Like that's stupid. That's crazy. And so I'm just like so thankful that everything worked and like we did it. Like how cool is that? So that's just how I feel. Just grateful for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening. Before we sign off, if you are a fan of the show, please consider supporting us with a rating and review in your podcast player, a donation on Patreon, or the use of our sponsor discount codes in the show notes. Thanks again. We really appreciate your support, really appreciate you listening. Until next time, I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and you have been listening to the Single Track Podcast.